Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 17th of July, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Thanks for joining us, Pat.
Glad to be with you, Mike.
We have Vanessa Bailey on video link as well, and we'll speak to Vanessa in just 1 minute. But before we start, Patrick, I just wanted to say a huge thank you to all the residents that we met at Grenfell Tower in the last couple of days. Well, you've got an image there showing some of the tributes from one of the walls, and we ran an episode of the Sunday Wire from the location.
Yeah, we did. We did a live broadcast on the street in the shadow of Grenfell Tower under the Westway flyover at Latimer Road, and it was quite an experience to do a live radio broadcast on the street like that with the public.
Yeah,
and so it was definitely memorable. Experience.
And the guests were amazing.
The residents are incredible. We'll get into more detail about that on tomorrow's program.
Yeah.
But I just want to say that the people and the spirit of the people in Ladbroke Grove and Latimer Road area is just unbelievable. And I take my hats off to all of them.
I couldn't say better. Okay, well, let's get on to the main subject of today's program. We're beginning with Banna of Aleppo. Just to set the scene here, Patrick, we've got a few mainstream media articles discussing Banna. This is, I can't remember when this is from, 2016, I think?
Yeah, this would be November and December 2015 is when this whole fiction sort of started. Here's
right.
The Guardian here, The Telegraph, everybody kind of did this in unison in the mainstream media. It was streamlined right across all media outlets. And as you can see, this is how they marketed the mythology of Banna of Aleppo here.
And she got some accolades. Time Magazine's 25 most influential people on the internet, from politicians and pop stars to rappers and gamers.
We see this is so important, Mike, these lists that are generated by big media publications. This is a way of sort of laundering credibility by generating lists and awards and top 10 most influential people in this area or that area. Here they've included a 7-year-old girl in this list of top 25 most influential people in the world online, and she herself wasn't actually doing the tweeting. So the whole story lacks a lot of credibility, but that doesn't stop the mainstream media, Mike, from running with the story.
Okay, well, let me bring Vanessa in at this point. Welcome to the program, Vanessa.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Right. We're going to mention this article in 21st Century Wire, Banna, the heartbreaking story of child exploitation, propaganda and media falsehood. And there's a video embedded in this, Vanessa, by produced by Khaled Eskef. And just give us a bit of the background to how this came to be made.
Well, this came to be made because we met with Khaled Eskef when Patrick and I went to Aleppo in April and May of this year. Khaled has been working kind of tirelessly on going through the various abandoned buildings, like the White Helmet centers, like the Nusra Front centers, like the hospitals that were being used by Nusra Front as Sharia courts, going through the documentation, particularly documentation that clearly implicates the British government in the funding of these various terrorist affiliated and terrorist organizations. So he actually, I think Patrick had spoken to him when we were there about the Bellingcat article that actually gave the geolocation of Banna's house. So Khaled made the decision to go and investigate the Banna story based on actually going inside her house, her parents' house, and looking at the surrounding area. And what he discovered was quite extraordinary.
Right. Well, look, just before we get on to showing some of the things that he discovered, just let me play a short clip from the beginning of this video, which again sets a little bit of context here, because this is a BBC interview with Banna.
Being shared. When your mum was tweeting, was she tweeting your words or tweeting her words?
Me and Mum.
Together?
Yes.
Her mother, Fatima, insists the Twitter account was Banna's idea, but admits it is a way to combat the regime.
So Banna's idea, Patrick?
Right. If you believe that, it's a very difficult one to sell. But what shocks me more, Mike, is the BBC presenter is not directly challenging that claim. They just sort of ask them what seems to be the tough question, then they answer with what looks to be a fairly disingenuous answer, and the presenter just moves along, doesn't challenge it.
So Vanessa, this is another example of the use of children, a bit like Dusty Boy.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, this is, and you know, we've since discovered, of course, that Dusty Boy, Omran Daknish, had in fact been completely propagandized by the Western media and the various extremist elements in East Aleppo. And notice how, since his family have come forward as government, Syrian government supporters, how those same media that iconized Omran in about 8 hours flat are not remotely interested in the child. So that demonstrates very clearly the level of exploitation of children for propaganda to promote war that will kill more children. And Bana, unfortunately, as a seven-year-old, is not cognitive of what she's doing. This is a child that is being manipulated. We saw when she visited the child, the other child that was supposedly had his legs blown off in a bombing raid in Idlib, I believe, but which has also been debunked. But we saw in the hospital room the mother literally pushing Bana to speak to the boy and telling her what to say. And in every interview we see this. We see that Bana is actually reading from an auto cue of some description, or that she's being prompted. So this is, you know, this is not about Bana in the sense of it's not Bana's fault. This is the fault of the media, of the entire network of propaganda producers that are using this child to further their regime change agenda inside Syria. It's appalling.
Okay, well, let's have a look at a little bit more of Khaled's video here. This is him walking through the some of the buildings in and around Bana's house. And he's basically making the point that Bana or whoever was running her Twitter account defending Al-Nusra Front, that these areas were absolutely under the control of Al-Nusra Front.
Yeah, absolutely. Because what he demonstrates is that exactly where Bana's house is, which is clearly proven to be her house, there's various artifacts in there that are shown in her tweets and in some of the video that I think was shown on Twitter. But he then shows that the Nusra Front headquarters in that particular district was literally right next door to Bana's house. And actually, what he's saying there, they show the images, Bana and Fatima. Fatima is the mother who we believe does the majority, and I think it's even been admitted that she does the majority of the tweeting. They talk about the Russian and Syrian bombing, but they're not explaining that they're right next door to a terrorist headquarters, to a terrorist center that is harboring known criminals and Al-Qaeda terrorists. So it's a legitimate target.
Yes.
And here, in fact, what he's doing is he walks around the Nusra Front headquarters. And here, of course, we see the Nusra Front emblem and flag that would have been hanging somewhere within those headquarters. But I mean, even testimony on the ground in his video tells us that what this area is, what it was used for, who was running it, who was controlling it. And what is very important, not only was Bana living next door to terrorists, but her father was directly involved in those terrorist organizations. And that is very clearly explained in the video from Khaled. Do you want me to run through what the father's own documentation told us?
Yes.
About his involvement? Okay. Well, basically, the father was educated in law. He was the director of the civil registry of the Aleppo, East Aleppo Council. Now, the East Aleppo Council was actually run by a guy called Abdul Aziz Maghrabi. Maghrabi was with the Al-Tawid Brigade in 2012 when they invaded East Aleppo. He then actually became not only a Nusra Front leader, but also the originator of the White Helmet organization in East Aleppo. So while a Nusra Front leader, he was also leader of the White Helmets, but he was also the elected head of the East Aleppo Council. And Khaled found clear documentation from the UK government and organizations like Adam Smith International, Integrity Consulting, clearly linking payments to the East Aleppo Council. So payments directly, effectively, to Nusra Front to distribute among the extremist factions in East Aleppo. So that's very important. He was working within the terrorist Aleppo Council, but he was also lawyer to Britta al-Hajj. Britta al-Hajj was a member of Ahrar al-Sham. Britta al-Hajj declared himself mayor of Aleppo, although he was only mayor of the illegitimate East Aleppo Council that consisted of terrorist factions, including Nour al-Din Zinki. Hajj came to Paris, to France, with the white helmets and was photographed with President Hollande. France basically put him forward for the award of Mayor of the Year in 2016. But Hassan al-Abad's family, so Bana's entire family, were a family of gun runners. He himself was also, according to his own diary, according to his own documentation that was found in the video, a military trainer of the Islamic Asafwa brigades, which are another extremist, one of the 50 extremist brigades in East Aleppo. He was judged for the same brigade until February 2016, and he was working with ISIS in the eye hospital that we also went into when we were in East Aleppo in April and May. And we saw the prisons, the execution chambers, the ISIS logos, the Nusra logos, and the remnants of the terrorist occupation of that area. So this guy, the father of Bana, is one of the most foremost, one of the most prominent members of the various terrorist brigades working inside East Aleppo. And he was effectively involved in the judgment of whether civilians in East Aleppo should be executed or not, whether they should be tortured or not, whether they should be imprisoned or not. So this is not some benign presence in East Aleppo. And according to various mainstream media articles, you know, he's described as a lawyer. He's described as having been against the terrorists, having been against the terrorist occupation. Yeah, right. So he's living right next door to Nusra Front. And he's casting judgment over whether Syrian civilians should be executed or not under Sharia law, under ISIS Sharia law, and he's gun running.
So put this all into context. It's perhaps not surprising that 7-year-old Bana was tweeting this type of thing. So this tweet says, "Dear world, it's better to start the Third World War instead of letting Russia and Assad commit hashtag Holocaust Aleppo." And first question in my mind, Pat, is... does a 7-year-old understand what the Third World War, what that term means?
You could pick out any number of tweets that this were attributed to this girl, supposedly, and this one is just happens to be a good example that indicates that we are looking at a complete hoax, a fraud. Okay, there's no other way to describe that. Bana, in her own videos, does not speak English. It's clear, many different videos, we've posted many, there are many on YouTube. She doesn't actually speak English. Maybe she can speak a bit better now after 6 months of intense coaching and doing media interviews, but back in December, nothing. Mm. So it is a fraud on so many different levels. What's more shocking, Mike, was how eager the mainstream media was to take this story, this fraudulent media propaganda story, and run with it. And how many celebrities also sort of, you know, rushed to make this their cause too. It's shocking that editors from The Guardian and newspapers like this would look at this and think that that was a real legitimate sort of news feature. I mean, what were they thinking over in Islington, Mike?
Yeah.
What's going on over there? Yeah. This is the question.
Vanessa, just before we move on from this, I wanted to ask about Khaled himself. How is he living at the moment? I mean, he has produced this video, but he's not getting paid for doing that.
No, that's a very good question. I mean, basically, Khaled, before the war, was a computer engineer, not like so many, you know, who then went into journalism because it was the one way that they could work towards exposing the propaganda that is attempting to destroy Syria, and particularly Aleppo, for the last 5 years. He receives no funding for this. He receives no help whatsoever. So if anybody does want to donate towards his work, then please, please do, because this guy is working pretty much 24/7 to produce these exposés. And actually, what I just
sorry, Vanessa, to ask, do you know how people can donate to them? Is there a way that people can?
Well, I mean, the best way is to probably donate either through yourselves or through 21st Century Wire, but to make it clear for whom that donation is for, because he can't, because of the sanctions and so on, it's impossible for him to raise money. And then when one of us goes to Syria, which might be relatively soon, we can take those funds with us or send them through Lebanon to him. That's the other way we can do it as well. So if people, because he is literally doing this all off his own back. And one of the things I wanted to make clear, when he was researching, you know, cross-linking the tweets that Banner was putting out and the location, what he actually found was some of those tweets and some of those videos had been filmed inside the Nusra Front headquarters. So this wasn't, you know, this was preordained. I mean, this was a program of propaganda, and Bana was being used for that propaganda, not only by her family, but by Nusra Front.
Okay. Thank you. Right, let's move on to this then. This is a German blogger. And interesting blog post here discussing Banner. In English, it says Banner from Aleppo Part 2. Banner is a client of the London PR agency, the Blair Partnership. Now, I have no idea of the accuracy of that at this point in time, but that is certainly the allegation that is being made by one commentator in Germany. This person seems to be under attack at the moment, Vanessa.
Yeah, this was actually highlighted to me by Carmen Ranieri on Twitter, who helps a lot with the research. And she pointed out the fact that this German blogger, actually his sentencing comes through today, so we will actually hear what the eventual verdict is. But what is also interesting, this case is being brought by Stern, who, of course, was involved in the huge scandal a few years ago for printing the fake Hitler memoirs. So it's slightly ironic, to say the least, that they are now attacking a blogger, not even a mainstream media journalist, for basically pointing out the anomalies in the Banner story, which many people have done in various other European countries and in the United States. So what is extraordinary is the level to which censorship has been brought to bear on this blogger in Germany. The process costs alone will be 100,000 euros and maybe 6 months in prison if he loses the trial.
What has he actually been accused of?
Falsification.
Right.
Right. And actually, he says, he wrote, the conclusion of the judge is that journalists can't be called fake news brokers anymore, not even when fake news are proven. It's a very interesting test case to some extent, because to my knowledge in Europe, it's the first time that I've seen someone actually being taken to court by a mainstream media outlet against a blogger. I mean, against somebody who is basically, you know, forming his own opinion and drawing his own conclusions. Apparently, that's no longer allowed.
Patrick, this is a very dangerous precedent if he ends up being found guilty.
If he does, but quite simply, if he is found guilty, Mike, then this says more about the court system in Germany, I think, than anything, because there is ample evidence to show that this is a manipulated propaganda campaign. The usage of this 7-year-old girl to basically put forward a geopolitical agenda that's championed by the West. It's beyond a doubt. Mm. And anyone couldn't stand up in court and sort of make any other point. So if they are attempting this, maybe he doesn't have the money for a good lawyer. Maybe they'll crush him with their legal team. Because you can be correct and still lose in court, Mike. Mm. We know this from the ITV Penny Marshall case. In Bosnia.
Absolutely.
So it is possible to lose even if you have the facts on your side, because you don't have enough money for an expensive legal team.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to this one then. Getting back to Banner herself, Vanessa, and Bellingcat, we wanted to discuss this organization.
Yeah. You mean Elliot Higgins?
Yes.
Erstwhile Brown Moses. The producer, but you know, Bellingcat is the is the producer of the hype on the chemical weapon attacks, the so-called professional investigations based on non-chemist analysis, I have to say, of the various chemical weapon attacks, and the provider of, if you like, the impetus for the propaganda towards further intervention and escalation in Syria. Higgins himself has a fairly interesting background. I'll probably let Patrick fill you in more on that. But this article in particular, I mean, having just told you what Khaled found, for example, it's a clear sort of attempt to whitewash all of the previous information that was being sort of exposed regarding Barna, which is now, of course, confirmed by Khaled's on-the-ground investigation. It connects her, of course, to J.K. Rowling, who has been instrumental in raising the profile of this seven-year-old girl, and therefore raising the profile, I have to say, of the terrorist factions inside East Aleppo. And there is very little response from either J.K. Rowling or from Simon Schuster, the publisher of Barna's book to be, to the various accusations and the evidence that, that is being levied. Not at Barna, but, you know, we have to keep making this point. It's not at Barna. It's at the whole apparatus that is forcing Barna to take part in this charade. But what is interesting, of course, when you take out a few of the excerpts from that article on Barna called, I think, Finding Barna, her father, Hassan Alabed, reportedly works in the legal department of the local council. Notice how they completely play this down, registering births and deaths. He currently describes himself as an activist against terrorism and ISIS. So hold on, he's working with Nusra Front, but he's against ISIS. The same old argument. Something of a poet. How sweet. While he's gun running, he's obviously found time to write a bit of poetry about it. Lamenting the destruction of Aleppo is on his Facebook page. Mother Fatima is an English teacher, so therefore, you know, she's able to produce the tweets and the interviews that have, again, propelled Barna onto center stage. And I actually find this very, very sad that a mother could be exploiting her own child to this extent. And if we go back to the Bellingcat article, there's a photograph in there that is part of the geolocation of Barna's house. And in that photograph, you will see at the end of the lane there, the sort of demolished car that is parked up on the pavement. If you then look at Khaled's video, you will see him walking down that exact same alleyway, and you'll see the same car is still parked there.
And so, also Barna tweeted out herself that this is our house.
Yeah. So it's just a nice little triangle to draw in the Bellingcat article into Barna's tweets and into Khaled's location and work around the actual location where Barna was herself. It just, you know, it gives it extra credibility.
Yeah. Thoughts?
I just want to reinforce something. You know, Bellingcat, this blog, it's a big tool in reinforcing Western propaganda, especially in the Ukraine, and demonizing Russia. And then it was deployed in Syria to sort of reinforce various narratives in Syria, like the Russian attack or Syrian attack on a UN aid convoy. These have been discredited. So the irony here is that in his effort to protect the Barna mythology, Elliot Higgins at Bellingcat also provided us with data that we needed to go find Barna's house and do the real research. Yeah. So that's amazing.
I'm glad he has some useful purpose.
So that was about as useful as a Bellingcat has ever been.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Okay, moving on, Vanessa, to the White Helmets. The United Nations, well, it seems like a whole bunch of permanent representatives to the United Nations have got very upset by Russia's recent intervention.
Yeah, I am double-checking this, but the funny thing is that the title of that intervention is exactly the same title as my intervention that I gave in April, and I have to say that certain Russian officials asked me to send over that intervention, which is White Helmets, Fact or Fiction, and this was then presented at the UN. Now, this has caused some consternation, very obviously, among UN member states, and knowing if they did use the evidence from the intervention that I gave in April in London, it will have created some consternation, because there's very clear reference, evidence and proven points against the White Helmets in that intervention, including, of course, all their various participations in executions, their affiliation to Nusra Front, the testimony from East Aleppo Syrian civilians, their affiliation to NATO states through funding, et cetera, et cetera. And what is fascinating, yes, they've given a sort of a limp, knee-jerk reaction. And this declaration was signed by various people, including, you know, the permanent representative of Denmark, France, Germany, Netherlands, New Zealand. New Zealand, by the way, the New Zealand fire brigade are now training the White Helmets in Jordan. Matthew Rycroft, of course, of Great Britain, Nikki Haley, Canada.
NATO countries, in other words.
Yeah, in other words, the funders and the supporters of the White Helmets. But what is extraordinary, if you actually go through the statement, all it does is reiterate the same old propaganda about the White Helmets. It doesn't actually address one single accusation. It simply tries to deflect back onto Russia, sort of saying it was all, you know, the usual stuff about Russia bombing hospitals, despite the fact that, of course, those hospitals were occupied by Nusra Front. And it sort of rebangs the drum about the fact that they've saved 100,000 lives. Now, bear in mind, this organization has given multi-million support, and yet it cannot produce any sort of inventory. It cannot produce any kind of accountability. It cannot produce any sort of record of these 100,000 lives that it claims to have saved, i.e. date of incident, names of those they've saved, families they've saved, nothing. I mean, nothing is being produced to verify their fantasy account of what is going on inside Syria. And of course, as I said, you know, when you look at some of the propagandists that, of course, support the White Helmet, this was tweeted out by Amnesty International, Chris Chan on Twitter. It was supported by Professor Scott Lucas of EA Worldview, who, of course, it notes that the smear campaign against the force, meaning the White Helmets, interesting use of word, actually, has accompanied the sustained Russian regime attacks on medical services. So it again tries to deflect back to Russian and Syrian liberation of their own territory from terrorist factions supported by the White Helmets. So basically, what was the point of this statement? What was the point of it? Because it addresses absolutely none of the accusations that should be responded to by all of these heads of state, by heads of UN representatives, because their taxpayers are funding this organization. So where is the transparency?
Well, there isn't any. And of course, I'll just mention again that I'm still working hard to try and get these quarterly financial statements from the Foreign Office, which they have acknowledged they have, but at this point are refusing to give me. We will keep you posted on that. But just discussing funding of terrorist groups in Syria, the Telegraph here saying charity cash is going to fund terrorist groups. But of course, we can't actually find out because Amber Rudd has said that we can't discuss funding of extremism in the Middle East because that might be a problem for national security.
Yeah.
No transparency there. And so using this to sort of avoid fob off the public or any serious inquiries into what is a real, acknowledged by many people as an actual real problem,
yes,
a real situation. So again, the government playing the role not in dealing with the problem, but in covering up the problem.
Yeah. Vanessa, look, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, if I can just make a point about that as well.
Yeah.
I think what is also very important, this was also highlighted in 2013 in a Telegraph article, and it's now being reiterated. But what is very important, there's two points here. One is the UK government, through UK aid, is funding a number and sponsoring a number of NGOs and charities that are fundamentally supplying the terrorist factions inside Syria. So the UK government is actually creating, sponsoring, funding, and supporting and promoting the NGOs that it's then accusing its own public of funding and funding terrorism through them. Now, we said this on UK Column a while back that the British government would work through the Joe Cox Fund to implicate the British public in the funding of terrorism, to defuse and to deflect their own culpability in the funding of terrorism inside Syria. And that is exactly what they're doing with this ploy, is to basically implicate the public so that the public is rendered, oh, well, we can't protest about this because actually, you know, we funded terrorism ourselves, but we don't actually know how. So one, there should be transparency on the NGOs that they're now saying are extremist funding NGOs. But two, what about the White Helmets? They're happy to continue taking public money into the White Helmets when the White Helmets are clearly not only affiliated to Al-Qaeda, but in many cases are Al-Qaeda. So, you know, it's sheer hypocrisy. It's an attempt to transfer culpability onto the British public. It's disgusting.
Yeah, okay. Now, look, we want to move on to Independent Diplomat. Now, before we get into this, just we spoke about this, I believe it was last Monday, but just remind everybody who Independent Diplomat is and why we're interested in them, just briefly, Vanessa.
Yeah, well, basically, I mean, the program we did last week exposed the funding from the UK Foreign Office Conflict Stability and Security Fund through International Diplomat, an organization, Independent Diplomat, that was set up by Con Ross in 2004. Con Ross came from the UK Foreign Office. And that funding went through Independent Diplomat into, among others, into the White Helmets and into the Syrian opposition in order to destabilize Syria and to effect regime change.
Okay, so this is from their annual report, I think, a couple of years ago, and they're saying that they were pushing money into the Tamils, into Syria, as you've mentioned, into South Sudan. So three regions of the planet, which, of course, are completely peaceful. Patrick, what can we say? Right, they go on to talk about the three pillars of effective diplomacy, political strategy, legal advice, public diplomacy. I'm not sure if you've got any thoughts on what any of that means, Vanessa.
Well, I think it's just a blueprint for intervention, isn't it?
Right, okay.
Infiltration, intervention.
And they do give us some financials, though. So in 2014, 76% of their money went on what they describe as program expenses, 18% in management and general, 6% for their fundraising itself. But here's the revenue by source, 42% is government. I'm not sure how much of that came from the Foreign Office, the UK Foreign Office, 32% from foundations, 25% from clients, and 0.3% in individual donations. The majority of it coming from government and foundation money.
Absolutely. I mean, this is basically a predominantly UK government. When you look through the FARA reports, the reports that were filed in the FARA department in the United States, the majority, some are coming in, for example, from the Dutch, from the Netherlands, but the majority is coming in from the Conflict Stability and Security Fund of the UK Foreign Office.
Okay, and just to show, they have a thank you page, and let's have a look at who they're thanking. They're thanking the Open Society Foundations, usual suspects here, but particular thanks for, George Soros, amongst others.
Yeah, and also interesting, they took in the foundation part, they also took from Humanity United. Now, Humanity United is a big connector. It's a big link between the originators of the Joe Cox Fund. So again, we're seeing the closing in of the net here.
And Karen Ross himself, as you say, ex-Foreign Office. Now, I watched his presentation that he gave on anarchism at a TEDx talk. And he expresses himself in a very Foreign Office style. It's something that can be recognized in other Foreign Office staff. But he is arguing, he says, for anarchism. Of course, he's talking about a particular, not the typical use of the word anarchy, not in the sense of chaos. But what he was promoting was participatory democracy, is what he said, combined with the use of cooperatives. And of course, if we look at the global governance agenda, Patrick, what we find at the heart of it is participatory democracy and cooperatives. And of course, what they're forming with these cooperatives is non-governmental organizations, which are formulated in a particular way. And then it is those third sector non-governmental organizations which are driving policy. It's them that get to participate. Now, when people think of participatory democracy, most people think of it in terms of individuals participating in some way, but this isn't actually the model which is being presented. And he is now presenting this model as a form of anarchy, which is quite an interesting twist on the whole thing to try and perhaps capture a different demographic. But Vanessa, we then have the likes of this from Rolling Stone magazine, with people that are calling themselves anarchists apparently going to fight Islamic State.
Well, yeah, I mean, if we actually, and what's quite interesting actually is that the article about the public funding terrorism through NGOs and Con Ross's anarchy article in The Guardian came out a day before and a day after our report last week on Con Ross. Could be coincidence. It might not be. But what is very interesting, in 2014, Con Ross's blog put out this request for information on anarchism, basically. But at the same time, what we saw, and bearing in mind that Con Ross had been employed by the SNC, by the overall body of opposition against President Assad and against the government in Syria, is that at this same time, we started to see those Rolling Stone articles, the New York Times articles, pushing the idea of the YPG in Rojava as being the new anarchists, as being the sort of the hip, new, young, revolutionary enigma that should be followed by liberals and revolutionaries in the West. Very, you know, clever marketing. They failed on the moderate. They failed on the sectarian narrative. They failed on even on the chemical weapon narrative. So now we get hit with the anarchist package. And Con Ross was definitely a part of creating this. I don't believe for one minute. Listen, the guy is taking almost 100% of his funding from governments and foundations. There's not much anarchy in that. So he's happy to profit from governmental organizations in order to further an anarchy concept inside Syria. And actually, Stephen Gowans, in a very recent article on this, not covering Con Ross, but covering the use of the YPG as the new kind of sexy revolutionary image inside Syria, is the fact that, well, actually, they're only proposing what is effectively in place under the current government inside Syria. So, you know, yeah, it's just another form of driving a wedge into Syria and furthering our government's geopolitical aims inside Syria. And, of course, the U.S. coalition, Israel's, Turkey's, et cetera.
Any thoughts?
Well, I just want to point out that, in addition to the the faux anarchist narrative that's being attributed to the Kurdish YPG, you'll see that countries like or as Syrians might refer to, Zionist entities like Israel will support Kurdish autonomy and a Kurdish oblast, if you will, in northern Syria, because that sort of validates an ethnic-based state, which Israel likes to push that idea to validate itself. And you also have religious-based states, which the Islamic State is, which Israel also puts itself out as, and which Saudi Arabia sort of does as well. So you see how these same some of these same parties will back that concept, because it then validates what they've created in the Middle East as well.
Okay, let's end on this one then, Vanessa, just briefly, because obviously the war, which continues to be mostly forgotten, is Yemen and Saudi Arabia's intervention there, along with others. The U.S., is this a bit of good news? The U.S. has voted to block, the U.S. House of Representatives has voted to block U.S. participation in Yemen?
Well, I mean, we saw, Rand Paul trying to push through various bills on preventing the continued supply of cluster bombs, the continued supply of arms to the Saudi coalition in its genocidal war of aggression against the Yemeni people. So, you know, we have to take some positivity from this, and maybe a sea change in the House of Representatives that overwhelmingly, according to this report a couple of days ago, approved two amendments to the National Defense Authorization. The Davidson Amendment, which prohibits U.S. military action in Yemen, and the Nolan Amendment, which prohibits the deployment of U.S. troops, which, of course, they have already done in the south of Yemen, in order to participate in Yemen's civil war. But Nolan's amendment, and this is interesting, would block the U.S. refueling of Saudi and UAE warplanes that are actually bombing Yemen. So that one is well, they're both important, but that both of them focus on that aspect. And if those could be pushed through, then, and if they're obviously adhered to, then they would have a huge impact on preventing the Saudi coalition from continuing what is really the massacre of the Yemeni people. It's an illegitimate war. It has no mandate whatsoever. It has no legitimacy. It's based in an illegitimate resolution at the UN. It's based on reinstating an illegitimate president, Mansour Hadi, that was a Saudi puppet in the first place. So, I need to look into this further. I need to see whether any congressmen have actually made any comments about this or are able to give any quotes and then write up on it. But it's potentially, yes, it's a potentially a sea change. And as you say, it's the world's forgotten war, a cholera outbreak that is decimating this already hideously deprived society. Something really, really has to be done about it.
Patrick, do you think the Pentagon would respect this?
I don't know. It's we've seen efforts like this before, similar efforts on different issues. But you know, it depends how Washington's being run. There is a little bit of a power struggle going on between the White House and the Pentagon. And so, you know, how much sway this branch of government has over actual policy on the ground remains to be seen. How much teeth something like this might have.
Okay. Well, look, thank you very much, Vanessa Bealey, and thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen. That is it for today. We will be back at the same time tomorrow, 1 p.m. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.